Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, November 30th, 2018. A member of the former SPLA detainee says he is not returning to Juba.
I think somebody has manufactured these stories. I'm not going to Juba until when I see that the agreement is really implemented to the letter and the spirit of what has been agreed and what has been signed in Addis Ababa based on what has been discussed in Khartoum.
And three South Sudanese soldiers are gunned down in Buma State.
The youth make an ambush to the SPLA and fought them and killed three and took back the cattle again. Deputy Auyao is working very hard. It's only governor that I appreciate, working very hard for peace.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The former Minister of National Security and head of the South Sudan Army says he will not return to Juba. Oya Deng Ajak, who is also a member of the former SPLM detainee, says he does not trust President Salva Kiir to implement the September 12 peace deal. Radio Tamazo reported earlier this week that Deng and South Sudanese politician Rebecca Nyandeng flew to Juba. Deng says that report is false.
We said we will go by any agreement or by anything that will bring the people of South Sudan together, and thus will take our people to peace, and we endorse it. As to whether I have gone to Juba or Mama Rebecca have gone to Juba, I think somebody has manufactured these stories. I am not going to Juba until when I see that the agreement is really implemented to the letter and the spirit of what has been agreed and what has been signed in Addis Ababa based on what has been discussed in Khartoum.
Deng Alor, who is representing the former detainees, is in Juba. He's part of the team that is overseeing the various institutions formed to implement the peace deal. Why are you still in exile?
You know, this is another contradiction, and I don't want to contradict and to abuse and to insult and to say anything negative, but we did not send Deng Alor to go to Juba. Deng Alor went to Juba without consulting and without sharing and without agreeing with us. And it is very unfortunate and it is embarrassing and painful that he went to Juba and he became part of the implementation process based in Juba.
How about Kosti Manibe? He's also in Juba sitting on the reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission. Did the former detainees give him a green light to be in Juba?
We agreed to participate in any of the committee of the agreement because we don't want to be seen as we are not part of the agreement. If Juba is committed and agree to implement the agreement, then Kosi will remain there. If Juba don't agree and Juba don't implement the agreement according to the metrics of the agreement, then definitely Kosi will not continue to be there.
One of your members, Ger Chuang, also went to Juba, and there are pictures of him meeting with President Salva Kiir. Is he a member of your advance team?
Yes, he's presenting the FDs, but I'm not part of those FDs because I have not been consulted, I have not been informed, I'm not aware of that mission. And he did not. Ger is my brother, he's my family. We have the same blood with Ger. If Ger go to Juba without informing me, then I don't claim to be part of that mission to Juba.
You said there are some good and bad aspects of the September 12 peace agreement. Can you talk about some good aspects of the agreement?
The good aspect of this agreement is that it said we have to build the new national army before we transform the new transitional national government. We have to build the new national police, the new national security. So we are basically saying that we have to restructure the security sector before we implement the transitional government of national unity. Now, this is the condition. If this one is done, to me, that is the most important thing. Because I really, to be honest and frank with you, I don't want Salva Kiir to come tomorrow was the new national army, which is 100% Dinka. And I don't want Riek Machar to come tomorrow was 100% Nuer. And I don't want Pagan to come tomorrow with a new a national army, which is 100% Chuluk. Or Thomas Cirillo to come was 100% Bari, or Sirino Etang or Mamour come was 100% Latuko National Army.
You were once the head of the South Sudan Army. Is it possible? How can you form a national army within 8 months?
That's why they give themselves 8 months to build this national army. And the 8 months are going very quickly. And this is my reservation and my question about the 8 month pre-interim period. And they're wasting their time on celebration, on wedding, on whatever fake things which they are doing, which are not serious.
That's Oya Edeng Ajak, member of the former SPLM detainees and former Minister of National Security. He was speaking with me from Addis Ababa yesterday. Refugees International traveled to South Sudan in October and visited the protection of civilian sites and collection centers for internally displaced persons in Juba and Wau. The group interviewed dozens of displaced people and spoke to several UN officials, non-governmental workers, and independent experts to understand the potential issues awaiting IDPs who are willing to return to their homes. Daniel Sullivan is with Refugee International, and he's with me in the studio here to share his finding. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Just tell us a little bit about your work with the Refugee International. What do you do there?
Sure. You know, Refugees International, we're an independent advocacy organization. We don't take any government money, and we don't have operations in the field. So we're able to have an independent voice when we go to places like South Sudan and talk to the people who have been affected by the violence and the displacement, talk about what their main concerns are and bring that back to Washington and more globally.
How was your experience in South Sudan?
It was, I've been there in the past, and it was, it's very challenging. It was very heart-wrenching to hear the stories of the people who have been displaced. There's a little bit of hope with the peace, the revitalized peace agreement signed in September, but a lot of waiting to see and realize what I heard from the people displaced is that they just don't feel like it's safe to go home yet.
And you came out and published a document detailing the situation in South Sudan and the issues involving the people who have been displaced from their homes. I understand you met IDPs in Wau and Juba. What did they tell you?
Yeah, I looked primarily at those who are in the protection of civilian or POC sites. Those are the places where people ran to the UN mission for assistance. And that's a small portion. There's almost 4.5 million people total who have been displaced. But the real conversation of returns now is focused on those POC, protection of civilian sites. And people there say it's very difficult life. They're very cramped. Services aren't great. There's a lot of crime in these sites. But with even saying all of that, they don't feel safe returning to their homes yet, or some don't have homes to return to.
And, I mean, you just say life in the POCs is very difficult. Why are the IDPs still there if life is very difficult?
Yeah, it's a balance of what where they feel more secure. It's not a very good life there, but at least they do feel safer than if they tried to go back to their homes. I mean, it was pretty stark. One man had a shelter in the POC site, and he pointed to a latrine right in front of his house and said, "This is not a very good life. I don't like it here, but it's just not possible right now for me to go home. It's not safe."
And I know that your work does not give solution to these problems, but what should the international community do? Help these people return back to their homes?
Yeah, it starts with the peace process. You need to have the security, and we've seen some of that improving. But the other thing is that efforts to make the places of potential return enable them to be conducive to returns, to be safe, to provide the kind of services needed, and also to make sure that you're actually carrying out these intention surveys with the IDPs themselves, knowing what their concerns are and making sure that they are in line with international standards, which means that they are safe, voluntary, returns and indignity.
And any thoughts on what the government is doing there? Did you speak to government officials about this situation?
Yes, I think, you know, the government is very much focused on the peace process. And there's a lot of interest in having people return to show that as that the peace process is having dividends. But the main concern is that it needs to be careful assessment of how safe it actually is and how secure the people feel about going back to
their homes. Just hold your thoughts there. We'll come back to you to hear more about what the UN is doing to these people. Authorities in Buma State say armed youth killed three government soldiers on Wednesday. The Speaker of Buma State Legislative Assembly says the youth clashed with soldiers who were escorting governor to Gumru County to try to recover stolen cattle from neighboring Jonglei State. Manyang David Mayar has the story for VOA from Juba.
Judy Jonglei Boyoris, the Speaker of Buma State's Legislative Assembly, says State Governor David Yao Yao was in Gumru County, west of the state capital, Pibor, meeting with chiefs and soldiers from the South Sudan Defense Force in an effort to recover hundreds of Jonglei cattle that were stolen during a raid last month.
After the governor collected the cattle, the youth make an ambush to the SPLA and fought them and killed three and took back the cattle again. So David Yao Yao is working very hard. It's only governor that I appreciate working very hard for peace, because he worked throughout. He does not actually stay in the office. He goes everywhere. Today in Gumru, 3 or 4 weeks ago was in the Kwangole.
In May last year, governors from Jonglei and Buma State signed a peace agreement in which they vowed to end cattle rustling and child abductions. But the deal was violated within days. Jonglei state officials reported multiple attacks that were suspected to have been carried out by youth from Buma State. Boyori says the Buma authorities have no capacity to enforce the rule of law.
Those who are going for cattle raiding, they are not from offices, they are not from the schools, they are not from where, they are from cattle camp. And Buma State is very large. If they want to go, we don't know. Until we heard that youth from Buma State attack Jungule or B State, roads are not there. In rainy season, nobody can go to Nanam. Nanam, how far is it? Nanam is too far. It's bordering Gadiang.
Boyori says the difficulty in reaching rural areas hampers the government's effort to control criminal activity like cattle raiding. He says state government will remain vulnerable in controlling criminal activity until roads are built and security forces can access trouble spots at short notice. He says if the roads are open, the state government will move closer to the people and enforce the rule of law. Jonglei state officials say they too have a hard time providing protection and security to its civilians. Atong Kwal Manyang is Jonglei state's information minister.
Sometimes these attacks, they happen randomly. And also the people that are supposed to protect these people, they are scarce in number. Like I mentioned earlier, in terms of logistics, in terms of personnel that will do this job and run after the criminals or protect these people, they are scarce. Because you hear there in Jale, there is incident. You hear in different areas. So it's like people are stretched.
Both Atong and Boyori say now that South Sudan's warring parties have signed a revitalized peace deal, officials from Jonglei and Buma states will work with the national government officials to restore security in both areas. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
If you have just joined us, we have Daniel with the Refugee International here with us in the studio. Daniel, this story we just heard about the killing in Buma State, are these some of the issues why the IDPs are still in these POCs? Are these some of the issues they tell you?
Yes, absolutely. There's various areas in the country that are still seeing violence. So the people they don't feel safe about. Again, not they don't feel that they can go home and that the conditions are right yet.
But you have a UN mission there, 17,000 troops, peacekeepers who are there with a mandate to protect civilians. What is the UN telling you when you are there?
Yeah, I spoke with several people in the UN mission, and a couple of things. One is that there's continuing difficulties in getting out to areas where there is need to protect civilians. So and limitations on doing night patrols, things like that. So I think there needs to be backing by the top levels of the UN, of UNMISS, of the mission to be able to do that. The other thing is confronting manipulation of aid. So there, in various areas, there continue to be, I mean, well, first of all, there's without international aid, we would almost certainly be seeing levels of famine levels. So it's critical that that aid continues. But it also needs to address where authorities are diverting aid, sometimes right to, into the hands of soldiers, or blocking aid, or using some of these this instability that we've heard about as an excuse not to allow aid into certain areas. So what the UN really needs to do, the UN leadership, donors, is speak with a common voice, a united voice, against these against those cases of instability and of blocking of aid, and make sure that the you know the government is not and the authorities are not blocking aid and making you know causing more suffering for the people that they're trying to help.
Yeah, well, Daniel, thank you very much for joining us on this show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
That's Daniel Sullivan of the Refugee International. He just returned from South Sudan, sharing his experience on the problems facing internally displaced persons in that country. A top South Sudan government official admits U.S. sanctions imposed earlier this year on 15 South Sudanese entities are hurting the economy. South Sudan's information minister says several companies find it hard to acquire American-manufactured equipment for their operations. A Juba-based analyst says the sanctions are likely to affect the South Sudanese economy for more time to come. Onen Walter Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
When the sanctions were imposed, the U.S. State Department said the South Sudan government and corrupt official actors used the revenue from the oil operators to buy weapons and fund irregular militias that undermined the peace, security, and stability of South Sudan. Information Minister Michael McQuay told members of the Committee for Information in the Transitional National Legislative Assembly on Wednesday that the government is working to invest in commercial companies to diversify its economy and reduce the country's dependence on oil revenues.
There is another company which we have registered. It should have actually been operational, but unfortunately it was affected by these American sanctions. It is called Niletel. Niletel should have been operational, but all the equipments that are usually bought, even by Chinese companies, parts of them are manufactured in America. So they were very much affected.
The list includes Ascom Suit Operating Company, Dar Petroleum Operating Company, Deitzman Nile, Greater Pioneer Operating Company Limited, Juba Petrotech Technical Services Limited, Nile Delta Petroleum Company, Nile Drilling and Services Company, Nile Petroleum Corporation, Nyakek and Sons, Oranto Petroleum, Safinat Group, CPET Engineering and Consultancy Services, South Sudan Ministry of Mining, South Sudan Ministry of Petroleum, and Sud Petroleum Operating Company. The U.S. Department of Commerce has not frozen the assets of the 15 companies, but requires that U.S. and foreign companies doing business with those on the list first obtain a license. McQuay says the move has affected the revenues the government would normally generate from the companies. Abraham Kwolnyon is assistant professor of political science at the University of Juba and a scholar on U.S. foreign policy.
The reason why the U.S. government is, or the Department of Commerce in U.S. are refusing for this company to allow them to purchase those equipment is to send a signal to the government of South Sudan that despite the fact that we have sanctioned other companies, our sanction is broad to the extent that we could still scrutinize companies that have an association with the government of South Sudan.
Kuol says unless South Sudan's leaders end the war and improve conditions in the country, the U.S. government may impose more sanctions.
Looking at the current status of how everything is going on in South Sudan, all the money that is going to humanitarian agencies is a donation from the USAID. The service delivery, health, education, food, security, all is from USAID. Assume a situation where USAID is supposed to remove its funding for South Sudan program today. That means South Sudan will be in a very bad shape. And in that case, South Sudan government should be able to know that they are there because US government is giving them a full support. Therefore, the current sanction is just only showing the way that there are more sanctions ahead that are supposed to come.
Kuol says the best thing the Kiir administration can do is improve its relations with the U.S.
The stake of South Sudan is to be able to renew their spirit toward the U.S. and try to align with the U.S. foreign policy interest by trying only to negotiate their interest and try to know where U.S. interests come in so that they will not be able to block all the U.S. interests.
Kuol says South Sudan's leaders should try to convince U.S. officials that it's not working against the U.S. and that their position should be pro-U.S. For VOA News, I am Onen Walter Solomon in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, some women find a way to make a living in South Sudan. Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Why is it important to look nice?
Yeah, it's important to look nice. It's 90% to achieve your approach. If you look nice, you'll be welcome easily by individuals or group or institutions.
So that people can easily receive you into their midst.
When you put on and dress on the nice clothes, on a nice body, probably you will become a very beautiful man, a very nice man. People will keep congratulating you. And on that process, you are also changing others to your way.
It's important to look nice so that others will not look down on you.
So good to look nice, to promote personal hygiene and try to attract others. Whenever you look, you keep yourself to be nice. It controls very many diseases and it keeps one health.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Some South Sudanese women who did not get a chance to receive formal education are now making a decent living from recycling plastic bags into handcrafts. The women collect polythene bags from garbage bins and knit them into handbags and other items. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Rita Dralero sits on a plastic stool holding a needle and a half-made polythene handbag at a training center run by the Women Empowerment Program in Juba's Nyakrum suburb. The church-based NGO helps train women in practical skills like tailoring or handcrafts so that they can support themselves financially. Dralero is one of dozens of women at the center who have either dropped out of school as children or have never been to school at all. Dralero dropped out of school in senior two after she got pregnant 10 years ago. She is now a mother of four. Dralero says she relies on her skills of handmade crafts to earn money to feed her family. She says being able to sell her handcrafts has changed her life.
Before I joined here, I moved with the whole day in this sun heat, and I had small girl. I moved with that kid. The kid can get tired, and I get tired, but now when I did this one, I sit in one place. Doing my work I stay in one place.
Dralero and other women collect polythene bags tossed away by consumers and knit handbags, wallets, and key holders. Some of the items sell for up to 5,000 South Sudanese pounds, or about $21 in the local market. Dralero says she uses the money she earns from her craft to pay her children's school fees and meet up.
That report by Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba tells us more about the struggle women have in South Sudan. The story of Nyalong, a South Sudanese girl who was married at a younger age, was reported by several local and international media. Some members of Dinka community in South Sudan took issue with international media, including VOA, for what they called inaccurate reporting of Nyalong's story. With me on the line from New York is Ambassador John Akech Koch, former South Sudan's ambassador to the United States. Ambassador Akech, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I see that there's a lot of problems in South Sudan. People are not happy with the story of Nyalong, and I see you're one of the people who said the media got it wrong. Can you tell us what happened with Nyalong?
I said the media got it wrong because of talking about an auction. But in South Sudan, among the Dinka, there can be no auction for a young girl, because the girl, in order to get married, must know the potential groom and must interact with him until eventually she can decide to let him talk to her eldest through her mothers. So that process of knowing the person requires personal consent. So there can be no auction.
And how do the Dinka conduct their marriage? If you're saying that what was reported was wrong, how do they conduct their marriage?
Well, as I started with the process in the beginning, there might be more than one applicant for a girl. The girl has to attract the young person, the potential groom, and through that attraction, the person gets, the potential groom gets to know the background of the girl. For example, Nyalong, whose father was a very good wrestler and for whom many songs have been composed to praise his wrestling ability. This also attracts many others. So there is not one person competing. There are many of them in most cases. And so the elders decide on who should be the right person to marry the girl on three conditions. One, that the girl will live happily with her potential husband. Secondly, the husband will be able to take care of maintaining good relationship with the parents of the girl. And number three, he should be able to pay a reasonable dowry according to the qualities and to the number of people within the family.
Yes, and child marriage is a big problem now in Africa. There are people who have come up, activists are coming up condemning it. Why is your community still practicing that? Because looking at the picture of Nyalong, she is a child.
Yes, she's 17 years old. But if you look at many other communities in Africa and even beyond Africa, how many countries have 52% of their girls married before 18 years? For the Dinka, once the girl arrives to her first period, this is the time when she is considered to have become an adult socially for us. But then people wait for a number of years, 3 or 4, until the girl herself feels that she's marriageable. She can undertake responsibilities in her own house. And if she's not willing to be married at that time, nobody can go ahead with the marriage. So I don't know. This is Dinka tradition. And it has been on for ages, and it will continue so. It is not that we disregard human rights and child rights, but it is a tradition.
All right, Ambassador John Akech Koch, thank you very much for joining us on the line from New York to explain these issues to do with child marriage. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. But we don't know what tomorrow brings in this crazy world.